people move. That might be the easiest subject-verb combination ever, because human beings are famous for moving around the planet. We take it for granted now that we'll move hundreds or even thousands of miles away for jobs or family. Now imagine that move of hundreds or thousands of miles in a tiny boat on a huge ocean. That's how humans scattered across the Pacific a long time ago. And three researchers have some theories about how winds and currents and other conditions shaped that scattering. They published a paper called Using Seafaring Simulations and Shortest Hop Trajectories to Model the Prehistoric Colonization of Remote Oceania. No short titles in science. One of the authors is Dr. Scott Fitzpatrick. He's an archaeologist at the University of Oregon and director of undergraduate studies in anthropology. And he's our guest in this month's installment of Curious, Research Meets Radio. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Which part of the Pacific are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about nearly all of the Pacific. It's an area that we call remote Oceania, and it's given that name because this was a part of the Pacific, which encompasses most of it, which explorers set out to explore but could not see other land masses once they left the one they were on.
So how impressed should we be by the ambition and drive of the people who did the colonizing? This is a pretty ambitious thing in a big ocean with a small boat.
It is. It's what many prehistorians would consider the largest and most expansive diaspora of people in the world. I mean, when you think about it, the Pacific Ocean is one-third of the world's surface area. So you could take all of the land masses, all of the continents, all of the islands, and scrunch them together, and the Pacific Ocean would still be bigger.
Wow. That's a lot of water area. How long ago are we talking about here, Scott?
Well, we have a pretty good chronology based on radiocarbon dates and lots of other evidence that suggests that people first started moving out into these remote islands in the Pacific as early as about 3,200 to 3,400 years ago. They didn't get to some of the more remote ones like Hawaii or Easter Island until about 800 or 1,000 years ago, but we have a huge expanse of ocean, tens of thousands of islands, not all of which were colonized, but that were tricky to get to, and that were required sometimes months on open ocean without seeing any other landmass to get to.
So, did the colonization come from East Asia then?
Well, it looks to have come from somewhere in island Southeast Asia and maybe even parts of New Guinea. We have these different population dispersals that come out, one into the western part of the Pacific, so those islands east of the Philippines, and then also one that moved eastward from the islands around New Guinea, or possibly New Guinea itself, that moved east into places like Samoa and Tonga and Fiji.
So what factors do we think drove them to set out from their original homes in the first place, especially when we're talking about, as you just mentioned, months potentially at sea without seeing land?
That's the $64,000 question, really, because there are probably a lot of environmental and social variables that influence that. Some people seem to think that population pressure, even on some larger islands, may have been enough to encourage people to move out or force people to move out. We think that over a period of thousands of years before people actually went out to these very remote islands, they certainly had seafaring capabilities. So we have islands in the Bismarck Archipelago around New Guinea, around the Spice Islands. We have people that are getting to some pretty far away islands, 35,000 years ago. And we think that these areas around these islands maybe served as voyaging nurseries. And so people would have been perfecting their seafaring skills, their navigational skills, their technologies for building boats and making sails and things like that. And that eventually they became pretty aware of environmental changes that were happening, things like El Nino or changes in winds or precipitation that they would have kept track of, and that would have encouraged them to go in certain directions along a much easier path.
So they're getting to know their own seafaring skills and their craft a little better, and getting to know the conditions in which they'll be out navigating.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you mentioned sails, so what kinds of boats are we talking about here?
Well, that's also kind of a tricky question, because there are very few examples around the world even of ancient watercraft, and we really only have a few examples in the Pacific of even just portions of of watercraft. But what we do think when we look at the archaeological evidence, when we look at things like language dispersals and language similarities, that peoples most certainly would have had to have the sail and probably some kind of stabilization technique like an outrigger. And that's what really is well known in the Pacific. We think that eventually as people later on in kind of this last major pulse of population dispersal to places like to the most remote islands like Easter Island, Hawaii, New Zealand, and some of the islands in between, that they probably would have had to have the double-hulled canoe with a sail. And that's the precursor to the modern-day catamaran. And they would have probably needed something like that to bring more people with them, to bring provisions, animals, and plants, and to ensure that their trip was successful.
Dr. Scott Fitzpatrick is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an archaeologist at the University of Oregon and the Director of Undergraduate Studies in Anthropology. He is our guest on this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio. The U and the O in Curious obviously indicated the University of Oregon, where Dr. Fitzpatrick is from. You can join this discussion as we talk about people making huge journeys in small boats. 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, wow. So a catamaran, essentially, a double-hulled boat with a sail. So you can certainly get around relatively fast, but not fast enough to cover hundreds. And I mean, what is the longest journey we're talking about here?
Well, you know, we're talking about thousands of miles. And so if you look at where we think people colonized Hawaii from, for example, we're talking thousands of miles, thousands of nautical miles, and probably a two-month boat voyage. To get from where we think they came from, probably somewhere in the Society Islands around Tahiti or Moorea.
Wow, that is a long way. So how could they have had enough food and fresh water on hand for such a voyage?
Well, we've done quite a bit of, there's been a lot of ethnographic research and historical records on what Polynesians were doing at the time of European contact, for example. And we know that when we look at the archaeological record on some of these islands, they're bringing with them things like chicken, pig, dog. They're bringing with them rats, maybe purposely or maybe accidentally. And so we see in not only that record, but also the pollen record and other types of plant remains, that they're also bringing domesticated plants with them. And in some cases, like Easter Island, and Easter Island is probably the only island that we know of where people got there and they never left and they never received new immigrants. And that's based on archaeological and genetic evidence. And we have chicken there and we have domesticated plants. And so that first colonizing venture to Easter Island, that group must have had those things with them. And so they probably had the capability to store those plants on the big platform for the catamaran. They probably had smaller structures that people could get inside to sleep and to cook. They probably carried coconuts with them to many places, which are a great source of food and water, and had catchment systems for rain to kind of get them through those longer days.
So making the most of what the conditions provided for them on the way, for sure. So, yeah. Scott, I have to ask, though, I mean, aside from the $64,000 question of why they went in the first place, I guess this is the $32,000 question. Do we have any evidence of return voyages? Did they go back and get more people or more supplies and in the process might have been able to relay more information, for example, about the ocean conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. There are many, many cases of that happening. In fact, we have things like, you know, when people find obsidian in the archaeological record, pretty much anywhere in the world, it's a very prized resource because it's really the sharpest natural substance known to humans. And when that resource is found, it's usually traded pretty widely. And we see that in the Pacific. We see obsidian as well as other tool quality stone like basalt that's found in very few areas, but that is traded widely and it's found in dozens or hundreds of islands. And hundreds of sites around the Pacific. And so we can track this geochemically and track not only that, but also the styles of artifacts like pottery or stone or petroglyphs. All sorts of things show that peoples were getting to islands and they were coming back. They were probably getting new people. They were trading. They were exchanging. They were doing all sorts of things. So the sea, in many ways, was a highway for people to go to do the things that they wanted to do.
Definitely a back and forth then.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Scott Fitzpatrick, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from the University of Oregon. This is our Curious segment, Research Meets Radio. We're talking about the scattering of human beings across the Pacific hundreds, even thousands of years ago. He put a paper together in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences with researchers from Ohio State and the University of Calgary, published in October. You can join us now on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So in the initial phase, though, and I know this is hard to tell just from artifacts, but I mean, how much can we figure out about what they did in terms of picking places to go versus taking where the ocean took them?
Oh, well, that's also a good question. So people, as they go out into these pretty remote stretches of ocean, wouldn't always know what to expect. There's thousands of islands, but most of those are very small, like atolls or smaller reef islets, and they wouldn't have been able to sustain larger populations. And so people may have intentionally bypassed some of those islands and searched for larger islands, places like Hawaii or New Zealand. But they also were faced with a lot of challenges, too. While they were very expert seafarers, they were also, they also were succumbing to a lot of natural events, things like storms, changes in wind, unexpected changes in currents, and things like this. And so it was, it was very much a struggle in many ways. And we, I think one of the paradoxes is that in archaeology, the evidence that we have for things like this is only from the evidence we see. And there were probably lots of other ventures that went out into places like the Pacific that were unsuccessful, but we'll never find evidence for that. So we really don't know what percentage of voyages were successful or not. And there were certainly lots of places in the Pacific that we call them mystery islands because they have evidence for people getting there prehistorically, but at European contact, no one was living there. And so these populations seem to have gone extinct or they left because they just didn't have enough resources.
Let's take a call here. We have Ann and Eugene on the line with Dr. Scott Fitzpatrick. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Ann. Ann, you there?
If you were familiar with the work of David Burney on Kauai, who's done a lot of work on the sinkhole that's preserved a lot of things, and also, what about the ecological disaster that occurred when these human populations arrived at these various islands? Thank you.
Thanks, Ann.
Yeah, that's a very good question. That's something I actually look at a lot and in my research. So I am familiar with David Burney's work. He's done a lot of work in different islands, not just in the Pacific, but elsewhere. And he, and as well as a number of other researchers, are really interested in what sort of impacts that humans had when they first arrived to islands and how can we best track those. And what we see in places like Hawaii is that when peoples get there for the first time, Polynesians, they begin to have some kind of impact on the environment. They are bringing non-native plants and animals with them that are out competing native flora and fauna. Whether rats are brought in intentionally or accidentally is somewhat a moot point when it comes to ecological degradation because they're omnivorous, they breed very quickly, and they can quickly destroy things like bird populations. And so one of the findings we see in the Pacific, and Hawaii is a great example of this, is that native bird populations go extinct or they're extirpated. So they're found on one island, but maybe not others where they should be or they were native to. And these kinds of things, as well as land clearance for growing crops, which increases erosion, that sedimentation goes into coral reefs and it chokes those coral reefs and they die off. There's this cascade effect in many islands that we see where humans are causing many problems when they first arrive.
This must be tricky to detect as researchers, though, because it sounds like you had to dig a long way down to see what happened when.
In some cases, that is true. In others, the soil formation is not that great, and some of the archaeological deposits are, they can be less than a meter deep sometimes and still provide a record of 1,000 or maybe 2,000 years. So the accumulation of sediment and other human deposits is somewhat arbitrary and relative, but sometimes we do need to dig pretty deep.
Scott, what are the established theories about the movements of people in that part of the world, and do you and your co-researchers jump on that apple cart, or are you upsetting it a bit?
I think we're kind of somewhere in the middle. The prevailing notion has been that peoples who first moved into the remote parts of the Pacific may have first originated in Taiwan and moved down through the Philippines and southward into the Spice Islands, and then moved along the northern margins of New Guinea across those islands like the Bismarcks and the Solomons before kind of dispersing out into other places. That's primarily based on a lot of linguistic evidence. So all of the languages in the Pacific, apart from, you know, places like New Guinea, but all those islands north and east of New Guinea are Austronesian languages. They're part of the Austronesian family, which seems to have originated from somewhere in Taiwan. And so we have more than 1,000 languages that are related to that family that have changed over time. But that seems to be probably the most accepted notion of how these populations originated. But this this is, you know, as with a lot of things in anthropology and other scientific fields, is up for debate, and we have a lot of new evidence, primarily from genetics, that is really allowing us to look at these questions in different ways. And so I expect the next 10 years will, you know, may have altered that view a little bit.
We'll take a few more minutes with Dr. Scott Fitzpatrick, archaeologist at the University of Oregon and director of undergraduate studies in anthropology, talking about the scattering of humans across the Pacific hundreds, even thousands of years ago, back to maybe 3,500 years ago. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. This is our monthly visit with U of O researchers in Curious, Research Meets Radio. Was there a period, Scott, of especially intense activity or just sort of a long dribble over time? What did you figure out there?
In terms of population dispersal?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of looks like there's these little pulses that happen. And one of the curious things that we see in the Pacific is that as we get the first major movement of peoples going eastward from those islands around New Guinea, we call these peoples Lapita. And these Lapita groups move around, you know, 3,200 to 3,400 years ago, and they get out to they get out as far as Samoa and Tonga eastward, and then they stop. And there seems to be about a 2,000-year gap between when they get there and the rest of East Polynesia, and well, when the East Polynesia is settled. So, you know, people moving out of the Cook Islands, the Society Islands, Easter Island, New Zealand. And so there's a 2,000-year gap there. And we're not exactly sure why, but we think that once they developed the double-hulled canoe, that that allowed them to really disperse very quickly within a few hundred years to all of those islands. And that's a really, really expansive and quick movement of peoples in a relatively short period of time compared to what we see earlier. We see stretches of, you know, islands being settled, you know, over a period of maybe a few centuries. But there do seem to be these gaps in time that maybe are structured by environmental changes or just people developing their seafaring strategies and their navigational skills a little bit better in order to ensure that they were successful when they went out. Because I think they're like, you know, they were like a lot of people. They were willing to take certain risks, but at the same time, they didn't want to jeopardize their families at the same time.
You mentioned some knowledge of what we now refer to as El Nino. So do you think that they were aware of what the currents would be like and where they would take them?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. And during El Nino events, we get changes in precipitation, which kind of stop in the central part of the Pacific. So during El Nino years, that's why Southeast Asia is so so dry and why Australia has these droughts. And the winds also shift. So the winds, which are mostly prevailing going to the west, end up shifting and going to the east. And we think people recognize those episodic patterns that happened, you know, maybe every 3 to 7 years. And once they sustain themselves, those winds, they would have then ventured off into going eastward during those kinds of events. And so lots of different environmental changes, I think, coupled together would have been recognized by Polynesians and other peoples living in the Pacific and then help to ensure their successful voyages.
In addition to all the scientific research, are there oral histories among the people who live in these regions now that go back that far?
There are lots of rich oral traditions by a lot of peoples in the Pacific that have helped to structure our understanding of how people were moving around and where they may have came from. And a lot of linguistic research, too, looking at the similarities in languages and seeing how far they may have split off from a parent language or from some very similar dialect. And so a lot of languages, for example, in East Polynesia, while very different and maybe having somewhat of a different lexicon, are understandable by many Polynesians. And so although the time frame of those is kind of tricky to determine using linguistics, and even the archaeology doesn't necessarily shed light on that as much as we would all the time, we have a pretty good idea that that peoples were moving around, that they were staying in contact with each other, and that this was happening over a period of, you know, a thousand years or more, at least in East Polynesia.
Scott, I know you're coming at this as a scientist, but I mean, is there still some level of awe here at what people were able to accomplish in relatively primitive craft on a huge ocean?
Yeah, really, there's no question about it. Even experimental voyages using replicas of double-hulled canoes and other types of watercraft, honing the skills that have been maintained for generations and generations in some of these islands, they have come across, you know, all of the challenges and difficulties that are inherent in traveling over open ocean. And I think one of the issues with many scholars over the years has been that not only in the Pacific but in elsewhere is that you can go anywhere you want if you have a boat, and that's not necessarily the case.
Okay, we learned a lot today. Scott Fitzpatrick is an archaeologist at the University of Oregon, director of undergraduate studies in anthropology, co-author with researchers from Ohio State and the University of Calgary about the colonization of Oceania. Scott, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right, and that'll do it for this segment. Short break, and then back with Garrison Keillor.